The subject for the evening talk is three kinds of meditators. Today, I must say, I've been on my very, very best behavior. And due to the inspiration from Yanai's talk yesterday evening and the story he told of the wise rabbi. And so at the end of the talk, I thought, well, this is a lucky monastery. Only five to think about. And here we have 70 or 80 of us. For those of you who weren't here yesterday evening, the rabbi said that one of the people in the monastery was the Messiah. So today I've had the opportunity for the small groups and one-to-ones, and I've been incredibly kind and caring. I mean, you never know, do you? So, as an example, at 4 o'clock this afternoon, I made the announcement about the translation for Hebrew, and I turned to Yael, and she didn't hear a thing I said, and I thought, gosh, she's in such a transcendent state. Perhaps it's her. And then Nimrod came up to me, such full day caring for so many people in the kitchen and the staff and the many responsibilities, and he said to me, Christopher, your Birkenstock sandals are old and cracked, and would you like me to give you a new pair? And I thought, perhaps it's him. So mindful, so generous, so aware. And then earlier today I was speaking to Vicky over there, the lovely tall teenager from England who's come here with me, 15 years of age, and wanted to come to visit Israel. And she told me that she had been to see the film Titanic twice. And though she has lots of posters of Leonardo DiCaprio, she hasn't become attached to him. Perhaps it's her. So I thought to myself, well, I won't take any chances, and a sign will come of who it is. And then that lovely ceremony this evening at 6:15, and very, very beautiful, and which brought tears to my eyes. And many of you came to the Kabbalah Shabbat. For those of you who don't speak Hebrew, I will translate. This means receiving of the Sabbath. So if you didn't know this before, I'm happy to translate from the Hebrew to English. So during this lovely gathering that we had, I saw Stephen take the bottle, take the lid and pour it out and pass it around to us. And I fully expected, of course, that with the bread there would be the wine. And as I received it and tasted it, it was grapefruit juice. And I thought, it's a miracle. He is the one. Oh dear. So please be very kind to him. Oh dear. I suppose in a way it reminds me of one of your rabbis, that man born in Bethlehem and brought up in Nazareth, and of him going to the wedding festival, and the miracle of changing the water into wine, And I have to say, for the Buddhists would have been much more impressed if he'd changed the wine into water. Different tradition, you know. All right, I mustn't go on. I'll try to come back to the talk. The other matter, another little thought that arose while listening to the lovely talk of Yanai. He was speaking about communication and logic and all of those things. And I had rather a good example of how we can see things and which are not really what's there. And a very clear one came to me. And Stephen was telling me that in the autumn period he's off to the United States, and that would include a 6-week intensive meditation retreat at the Insight Meditation Center in IMS in Western Massachusetts. And one of the friends there who has sat many long retreats, she told me that some of the teachers, Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg and others, that some of the talks are exactly the same as they were in previous times. And some people say it can be very helpful to listen to the same talk because one gets new things from that. But sometimes she says she feels she knows the talk so well that when she comes into a sit and then she hears the name of the talk, she pulls a little box out, and they've got two little earplugs, you know, that you need when you don't want any sound for sleep. And she just there and just sticks them in the ear like this and meditates and etc. So I thanked her because next time I see people going like this in their ear, I'll know what's going on with my talk. And so right in the last retreat, there was a young man doing his first retreat and sitting there, and I'd never seen him before. And about the second or third day, I looked in the hall and, God, the worst thing happened. He pulled out this little box and he opened it carefully up and he pulled two things out and stuck them in his ear. And I thought, well, he can't say I've repeated them because I haven't met him before. Surely I'm not that bad. So anyway, I checked out with him later on, and it was quite the opposite. He has some disability in hearing. You see? So he takes his ear and he puts his little things in inside his ear, and then he can hear well and clearly. And I thought it's just a good illustration in life that we see something, and then we immediately jump to a conclusion, and in fact it's the complete opposite. And so this is a good teaching. Right, so anyway, we'll get back to the theme of three kinds of meditators, many kinds of meditation, but I don't want to put here three kinds of meditators. And in that, if I speak a little bit about each one, and possibly in that some, and hopefully most, if not all, will be able to connect with what I'm saying. The first is that we engage and commit ourselves to the process of meditation, and while engaged in it, we begin to experience within our inner life and our physical life various issues, hindrances, problems which are arising. They begin to stand out much more clearly for us. We've been speaking to this about you, the five hindrances, the desire, the anger, the boredom and other things. And there is an awareness and a recognition that with them that they need attention to, that we need more care and vigilance. We endeavor to use the resources via the meditation, of course, seeing them arise, stay and pass, therefore to see their change and impermanence. We use the resources of practicing and practicing again and again, not to cling and identify with them and hold on to them. We see the practice as somewhere where some things need to be accepted or let go of or given up or whatever. Sometimes we've needed just to follow the process and just see that that's rather an impersonal event going on, and therefore the movement of the mind is not me, not myself, not who I am, but there's just this process, this movement of mind is going on, and just learning to track it, learning to see it very well, very clearly, without clinging or reducing the clinging to it. And through the forms and through the meditations and the practices, been a lot of emphasis on this. And the teachings have said, and said rather wisely, that these are characteristics of existence. So what that means is, if we turn our attention to the bodily life, we see it as an organic process, and we see how easily we identify with it, we compare ourselves with others physically, many other features that we do, and we're saying, let's see the body as the body, and just see it as organic life. All of this we've touched upon various ways over the days. In the working with that, sometimes, as some of you have reported, that in the process of the meditation, sometimes one experiences a particularly difficult and a particularly painful area. And that may occur at any time and quite unexpectedly. We could say it feels like we're hitting the wall with ourselves. We really come up against something that seems very, very difficult. And it really is a test, a challenge to our mettle. Some of you will know from those of you who do think that I've got in mind here, long distance running as an example. And one runs X number of miles, and some of us, and include myself, who love long distance running, and then there can be a period where we call it, in running terms, hitting the wall. It means that mind and body are stretched to their limit, it seems, and every thought is to give up, to go somewhere else, to stop running, to avoid it, not to go any further, etc. And one got familiar with the wall, because one is practicing running, practicing long distance running, and one knows that there is the potential to get through the wall, and in getting through the wall there can be clear open spaces and fresh levels of energy on the other side. And so sometimes we, in the meditation, in the sitting posture, as some of you reported, one kind of hits the wall. When one hits it and it's very difficult, the thought will be to get away from oneself to something which is easier and pleasant. First thought would be escape, to do something else. And so the obvious escape, and people have the right to, is just to leave. And we as teachers and as staff, you know, obviously, unlike some elsewhere, some places, we don't put pressure on people in that way. People are adults and decide. So sometimes there's a wish to get away from. Actually, it's getting away from various deeply unpleasant sensations and the thoughts which go with it and the feelings that go with it. What else is there to get away from? It's deeply unpleasant sensations, sometimes in the body, sometimes in the mind, feelings and sensations, and various thoughts. And this sometimes seems too much to handle, too much for one kind of meditator. And of course, at times, without making it an endurance test, sometimes we need to be rather respectful to that. That being respectful might be, as I just spoke to one person a little bit earlier on, okay, so many sittings in the day, it is a hard day, it is a long day. Okay, so for some, to go more softly with oneself. And softly might be, okay, I'll just sit once between wake up and breakfast, once between breakfast and lunch, once between lunch and tea, and once between tea and sleep. I'll soften the intensity of what it means to be in here in the meditation hall, yet not get so dissociated that it's a kind of an avoidance of what's of things, an avoidance of facing my existence. So sometimes we need to be aware of that, and of course that may apply in other difficult situations in one's daily life as well. And sometimes there are members of the family. one is having a terrible difficulty in the communication or whatever, and the thought may arise, I don't have to deal with this person anymore, I just want to withdraw, I don't want to cut off all association, all contact or whatever. One's hit the wall with the person. Often and easily happens, a common thing. And so sometimes we have to then measure ourselves and say, okay, I can't see this person every day, or talk on the phone every day, or whatever, and just find a space yet without this pulling away from totally. All of this is trying to find a middle ground in life. So the wall will tell us, when we strike it or hit it, a lot about ourselves, and in fact about our relationship to lots of other things, because this is our mind. This is our life that's going on here. In the difficulties that may arise, and the working with them, it's important to understand here as well that the working with them can come equally from inner and from outer. What I mean by that, sometimes we have the view, well, with these issues and problems and difficulties that are going, I've got to work it all out myself. It all rests with me. And it's too hard and sometimes rather unfair on oneself to think one can do it all by oneself. So sometimes we have to be clear about that, to know ourselves well, and as is here and elsewhere, we work from the inner and we get support from the outer. And sometimes in the meditation hall, many of you don't know which person sitting next to you is on strong daily medication for the mind. You don't know which person sitting next to you in the hall here is experiencing cancer. You don't know which person in the hall here is carrying the HIV virus. You don't know which person in the hall here whose marriage is just finished, whose business has just collapsed, who's in a major area of crisis and can't go back to the old. But all those people are in the hall here. And when I speak, you all know who I'm talking about. You know, on the individual matters. But we don't know this. The teachers will know, but others won't know. One have no idea of the life circumstances of the person who is sitting next to you. And so sometimes when a person or persons hits that very, very difficult place, and all the struggle and anguish and conflict and confusion which arises in that very, very difficult place, sometimes that person needs us. Needs us through our silence, needs us through our respect, needs us through our sensitivity, needs us through just being caring. Why? Because we may not know the person at all, we may not know the major event that's going on in the person's life, and we may not understand the person. And sometimes one little piece of information changes the whole way of looking at a person. And there are people in this hall here who could give other people in the hall one sentence and one's whole feeling about this person would be different, completely different. But sometimes we don't, as you don't. We don't have access, that is the yogis, the participants, to this information. We have it because we're told. Not about everything and anything, but we hear, we're told personally and directly or on the forms or whatever it might be. So say sometimes the difficulties that people are facing are formidable. And again I say, sometimes it's too much to ask that the person herself or the person himself resolves it all. Therefore, the meditations, the silences, the support, the small groups, the one-to-ones, the teachings and the inquiries, the food, the kindnesses of the staff, etc. It's a way of saying, in very difficult situations, that we look at something from within and from without, and between the within and the without, we look at it to take the problem out of it. We look at it inside and outside, equally, as clearly as we can, so that which arises as an object of interest, for the person who looks at their state of mind as the object of interest, or state of body, and the person from the outside, so to speak, who looks at it, maybe between us, it can begin to lose its problem. And therefore, meditation is association with many other things. One of the most difficult areas, and every retreat, many commentaries on this, and it's one of the most difficult things, I would call it probably one of the widest social problems that I know, and it's so widespread that it goes unexamined. And that is the problem, it's a very severe problem, of people heavily judging themselves. It's so across the board, it's so frequent, in which in the inner life there is an accumulation in the inner life in which the mind on its own existence is acting as prosecutor, judge and jury. And this internalized mindset gives the illusion, and the tragedy of the illusion, that the prosecutor, judge and jury that goes on is some kind of independent, objective witness of who one is. In other words, we believe it. Mind comes into reactivity, is in negativity. The negativity connects with the thought, called the judge, the jury, the prosecutor, or whatever. And it says, you are like this. And then one is putting oneself down, undermining oneself, belittling oneself, comparing oneself unfavorably with others. And it acts as though it's independent. It acts as though there's some kind of unique courtroom in the mind which is stating the reality. Where does it come from? There's no separate judge and jury out there and separate from the mind, looking at the mind from outside of it. It's coming out of the mind upon itself. So even the self, when it's strongest, we say, I'm aware of this going on. I'm aware of how I'm putting myself down and judging myself and knocking myself and ridiculing myself and feeling a lack of self-worth and a lack of self-acceptance there. And I see that I'm doing it, but I still keep doing it. What's missing? And so sometimes for one kind of meditator, one seems to be in a process of meditation, of dealing with the wall, dealing with stuff which is arising, and dealing with this prosecutor-judge syndrome there. And of course that, obviously, in such situations, it isn't easy to work with. And you say, what would it mean in ourselves to see if we can listen to what? To a more kind voice. To connect with a little bit more kindness towards ourselves. Listen more carefully. And one of the important features of that, and something which the Buddha spoke of frequently, it's rather a beautiful word in the Pali, it's mudita. And mudita means appreciation, appreciative joy. And when there is some absence or shortness of appreciation for one's existence, when we're short of that, then, and there's therefore something is short in our emotional life, and there is like a hole there, a gap there, the mind doesn't like it, it reacts on itself. And when we've had some people have had the combination of being rather heavily negatively judged by others, both in the present, in the past, or in childhood, or in a painful relationship, plus the latent tendency inside, the combination of the negative judging from the outside and the latent tendency to do it, the bringing of the two together can make a very, very heavy prosecutor. Very, very heavy one. And therefore one says, what is in that pain of it all? That something in the feeling life needs nourishment. It's almost like a calling to us to say, well, what can nourish appreciation? What do we have to appreciate? You know, the Buddhists always tell the story of the turtle. One of the most famous of all the stories of the turtle swimming in the great ocean. And on the ocean there is a yoke. You know, it's that round thing that when ploughing the fields. And it said once in every kalpa is, you know, tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of years. Once in every kalpa, the turtle comes up to the surface of the water and it puts its head through the yolk. All this huge ocean, once every 10,000 world cycles or whatever, it pops its head up, and then when it does it, it comes up and it puts its head right through the yolk. And I say, God, isn't that rare? Extraordinary thing for that to happen. And then the Buddha says, human birth is like that. That rare. Of all the sentient beings that there are, all the universes that there are, all the galaxies that there are, etc., etc., here is human birth, human consciousness, human existence with extraordinary potential. And to have the birth is such a rare thing, yet we take it for granted. We take opening our eyes for granted and listening for granted. We take the ordinary and the everyday for granted. And it has a numbing effect on our life. And you say, if this appreciations, heart appreciations, just in small gestures for the ordinary can be cultivated, this cultivation will soften dramatically the harsh judgmental voice, because we're listening to life more deeply, and that appreciation reduces the anger, the negativity, the self-blame, the self-rejection that goes on so easily in life. Why? Because we haven't nourished appreciation. And many times in one-to-ones and small groups and within oneself, etc., through the day, many of you expressing many, many appreciations. And they're coming from the heart, and they're genuine, and they're intended, and they're communicated. That should be the normal experience of day-to-day life. And so that when a judge comes, it's not charged with reactivity. It's a sense something is being pointed out. It's not a sense of blaming myself and putting myself down and treading on myself and wanting to and hating myself. It's the judge comes in the voice of wisdom that says, this needs looking at. This we need to attend to. And it has a different feeling about, a different quality. Clear, but non-reactive. Direct, but non-aggressive. This is all part of our practice. So, as I say, sometimes one kind of meditator is the meditator attending to problems of life, issues of life, working with them from within, and of course from without, with the support. Second kind of meditator. And meditator will say of herself or himself, I engage in my meditations, and in my meditations I can't say I'm having a lot of problems. I can't say there are a lot of issues going on. I'm quite okay to be here. Don't have thoughts to flee. I don't have great issues or dramas to work on. But I can't say anything profound or deep or earth-shattering is happening. And I just come in and I just do my meditation. And it's, you know, I hear it's called insight meditation, and I've only done 25 retreats, and I haven't had an insight. And I'm told about going beyond the thought, but I just seem to think about it. And so I can't recall anything which has been really, you know, kind of turned the earth for me or turned my consciousness up or down. It seems to be just rather ordinary. And in that, I also haven't, you know, I've heard about these other things, but to me, you know, so sometimes some thoughts come and, you know, why am I doing this? Nothing much special is happening or coming out of it. Teachings and practices here, and I'll refer to it. I suppose you could rightly call it a bit of indirect advertising, and it is. And I'll address it in a moment. And what I mean by this is, sometimes in the meditations, sitting, walking, standing, whatever, reclining, that in the very flow of the meditation, one says nothing special, nothing significant is happening, so it's neither deep and profound on the one side, nor is it painful and problematic and harsh on the other. For some people, this is where one may, and will have to, of course, look to oneself with regard to this. Sometimes there's the process of the meditation which is emphasizing calmness. It's emphasizing, without one knowing, a kind of general relaxation. And obviously important. And the meditations seem to be some degree of mindfulness, but plenty of degrees of clearly not mindfulness. And one kind of feels the meditations is more or less sometimes a little bit more one called mindfulness, and others. Very little of mindfulness and maybe nothing at all. And yet nothing significant happening, it just seems in the level of the ordinary. With the ordinary, like that, it can grow to become ordinary to very unsatisfactory. Something, again, is not very fulfilling, even if the mind is relatively quiet, nothing too much going on, and one is just going from one sit to the other. Therefore, sometimes we need to introduce into it some kind of inner inquiry, inner questioning, which may help to enliven a little bit more the inner life. One may say, well, I'm not feeling numb or dull or bored, but basically it just seems kind of quiet and just some chatter of the mind and not much else. And just as with the outer inquiry, in the times that we've had them or questions that have been asked to you, it might be helpful and it might be useful as part of the practice for some of you to introduce some kind of inquiry. And this is where it comes to this book. So recently I had a book published, and if it's like the others it will be at the top of the least sellers list. And it's a funny, ironic thing. Slight distraction here. Those of you who are like myself have joined the grey-haired club. Have in England we used to have a decent national health service, but then the government started having to pay for things like going to the opticians to test your eyes. And I said, look. Just need a little bit more expansion of the. So I just went to the local chemist shop and said, minimum magnification glasses, and that'll do. Well, rather ironically, just the other day, I was actually reading, and for 5 or 10 minutes, this is something, isn't it? And I took the glasses off, and look. The finger goes through the hole. And so there I was, sitting reading, and one eye didn't even know it. There you go. Honestly, that is such a teaching. So if you find this other piece, otherwise I'll have to go to the local market and buy a pair of glasses half price, because that means one half will be missing and I can put it in. All right. So I put this book together. It's a terribly ambitious title. It's called Light on Enlightenment. After you've read it, you might call it Blight on Enlightenment. But anyway, and so it includes lots of inquiry, lots of questions. And the questions can be brought into the meditation. And in that, to give you I'll put my glasses back on, or maybe my glass back on. And so, as an example here, what is the significance of being here and now? You know, we hear it as an instruction. What is the significance of being here and now? And the mind, the thought, might go in a roll and start thinking. But it's not to generate more and more thought. What is the significance of being here and now? And to let the question, as it were, travel and sink rather deeply, inwardly listening, and to see what the response might come, maybe in the very sitting, later in the day, and others here which I've done. Since it's not possible to be mindful in every moment, because it needs energy and attention, and nobody can be mindful every single moment, not a human being, not a Buddha would ever claim it. Since it's not possible to be mindful in every moment, when it fades, what do you rely upon? When it fades, what's left? What is the relationship between mindfulness and liberation? What is the relationship? Someone's ordinary mind might say, I haven't got a clue. Of course it hasn't got a clue. But sometimes the question can rest. What is appreciation when the foot touches the earth? Where is the love when breathing mindfully in and out? I've got some others I'll show. Here's one, and it can be one question and a flow of them. Do your feelings constitute your reality? Do your thoughts make your reality? I'm like an old professor here, I know. Eh? Yes, I'm surviving. Do your feelings make your reality? Do your thoughts make your reality? Is reality a combination of the two or something else? Do your experiences of pleasure and pain reveal reality or make it? Do your experiences of pleasure and pain reveal your reality or make it? Obvious last question. What is reality? So, sometimes, here, as I say, sometimes, as I said, with one type of meditator, here, there's issues to look at and attend to. Problems of the mind, judgmental mind, etc. We must be true to what matters, what is. Some second type of meditator, nothing much going on, and yet some feeling of unsatisfying in some way or other. And therefore, to quietly but firmly raise a question and to let the question quietly and gently and firmly enter into the psyche, enter into the consciousness, enter into the mind, and let it be there. So the question is short, it's precise, and just letting it settle, and letting it settle. And if we trust in that, it can deepen our receptivity to the communications, and also, and equally, it may bring a deep response from within us. Are my feelings the statement of reality? Are my thoughts the statement of reality? Is it both the statement of reality? Or is it making the reality? And obviously these are important and profound questions of life, because they influence the very way we live. And therefore worth answering. And one says, what is the answer? It's one thing to raise deep questions of life. What is the answer? And the answer is that which makes a difference. That which makes things clear. That which opens our life up. That which takes the problems out of things. That when it makes the genuine difference, that's the answer. No, it's not philosophical, it's not Buddhological, or not theoretical, it's not metaphysical. In Dharma teachings, there are answers. There are genuinely answers to questions of life, to the deep questions of life, and one knows the answer because it makes a real difference in one's life. And that's the proof of it. Sometimes we respond and we touch strongly to something of questioning, and there's a response there, and it really means something for us. If it's gone deep, even though the experience has come and gone, if it's gone deep, something stays steady with us. I'm not talking about the memory, I'm talking about the wisdom, I'm talking about the understanding. It has the capacity to stay more steady with us. So one type of person, let's see, looking at problems, dealing with problems, and honest enough to work with them and be clear with them, work with them inwardly, outwardly. Another kind of person, meditations that flow along all right, nothing dramatic which is happening, and the sense that in some way something needs to be introduced to go deeper, therefore to ask the question, the inquiry expression or form that I referred to. The danger, small danger, but danger is that in raising a question, it starts to generate a lot of thinking. And in a way, when we go to thinking, in a way we're going in the wrong direction. We want to go deep, not to keep going to the, as they were, up to the thinking. And in that, if we get going to thinking, okay, we go back to mindfulness of breathing, we go back just to listening, we go back just to being with the body, to get ourselves grounded and centered as much as possible, feel centered, feel okay, not too much chatter going on in the mind, not too much noise, and then we say, okay, go back to that original question. And all that can help the journey of going deep. The Buddha says there are 7 factors of enlightenment. First is awareness, second is inquiry. And that inquiry taking place in the obvious forms, question and answers, dialogues with each other, and the inquiry which is internal. Both have a single problem: to make life beautifully clear, liberatingly clear, and therefore the problem of life or problems of life lose their grip. We don't feel we're any more a prisoner to the problems of life, and therefore life reveals itself in fresh ways. Then the third kind of person. Third kind of person doesn't fall in either of those two categories. And there are a number of you here and elsewhere, of course, where there's a kind of natural depth which is taking place. And therefore, that third kind of person isn't having to kind of attend to problematic existence. Meditations are not just kind of quiet with some chatter, and therefore might need something else to take go for the depth of things. But there is a natural, dare I say, evolution, natural development taking place, in which the consciousness is going deeper. And that's due to many, many factors. Inner receptivity, natural evolvement which is taking place, and that can and does happen just through the flow of the day. So some of you will, in listening to yourselves and in connecting with yourselves, say, well, not much of the first, not much of the second. I feel the way I'm doing it feels okay. I feel in touch with the rhythm of things, and then there's a natural kind of absorption taking place, a deepening absorption into the here and now. In the deepening of the absorption into the here and now, the mind loses interest to think about tomorrow or last week or be anywhere else. In the deeper absorption, one truly knows one doesn't want to be anywhere else. Process itself, without introducing, is actually doing itself. And in the doing of itself, there's a natural deepening which takes place. Sometimes that deepening, of which there are many forms, sometimes there's a deepening which goes and feels deeper, and sometimes, as Ajahn Dharmadhara, my older teacher, used to say, he'd sit and there'd be actually refer to it in the book somewhere. He would sit, and the monks and the nuns would be in the hall, about 200 of us, and sometimes it would be beautifully still, and beautifully, sweetly still, not a movement. And then he would say something, and then just move the hand, moment to moment, like this, he would go through the air, or like this. And one just sensed and felt and knew that one single movement affects everything. Everything. All of us were affected. The influence. It's sometimes just the fact of movement affecting the eyes. And so sometimes in our stillness, where there's an absorption there, there is no wish in the mind to move any part of the body. And sometimes we just move a little bit of the body there. Sometimes it feels like it's a disturbance. It feels like it's a movement. And so there can be periods, not necessarily the whole meditation or anything like that, where for those with a deepening absorption, this third kind of person, there can be periods and moments in the sitting of impeccable stillness. Absolutely impeccable stillness. And in that, for any event, as it were, to go on in the mind, a formation of mind, or any event to go on in the body, is kind of a minor detail. It's kind of secondary. So in the first two, there's a lot of the interest, of course, in the condition of mind and working with it. But the third one is much less interest in body and mind. It's just a deepening of absorption which is taking place. Appreciation for it is strong. Recognition of it is strong. No judging, no laying numbers, no harshness on oneself. And keeping faith with it. It's a wonderful journey that the consciousness can make. And with that, sometimes the receptivity just to listening to teachings. One listens and it's clear. One listens and it's clear because consciousness is steady enough to follow that. And if one takes the text, certainly the religious texts of the East, of which there are obviously many, 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 many of them, one of the features of the text, again and again, is that much discovery of what liberation is has come through communication. It's come in listening to teachings. It's come through dialogue. It's come through group. It's come through one-to-ones. It's come through inquiry. Much of the realization of things coming clear has come that way. And of course, it also can come by being in the nature, of course. It can come by deep inner inquiry, like I described, of course. It can come through the silence and the meditations as well. But if one speaks of overall, majority-wise, in the teaching, it's generally come through some kind of Dharma communication. So our meditations maximize our receptivity to teachings, and our teachings maximize our receptivity to freedom in life. So sometimes you see, oh yeah, at the present time, yes, I'm the first kind of meditator, issues to work on, I do need to attend to them, second kind or third kind. But all essentially, with differences, pointing in the same way, to the same thing, liberation, freedom, awakening. May all beings live with awareness. May all beings know themselves. May all beings live a free and appreciative life. So let's have a couple of quiet minutes.